Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Okay, everyone, it's takeaway time. I'm Tanzina Vega, and it's May 8th.
Think about it this way. Their boss is an algorithm. They lack a human connection to anyone else at Uber. It's sort of a disconnect there between the driver and the company.
Rideshare app drivers are taking a stand in 8 cities across the country today to protest working conditions. We hear from drivers.
I drive for Uber and Lyft in Philadelphia, and I'm very pleased with how the company treats me.
Uber and Lyft, unfortunately, depend on desperate people with no other recourse.
At the heart of the issue is whether drivers are employees or contract workers. Also on the show, the fight between House Democrats and the White House over the president's recent tax returns.
There's a natural conflict of interest when an agency like the IRS has to audit someone who is, in effect, its boss.
And we continue our look at the challenges military families face by talking with military spouses about struggles with their careers.
When I tell him about the things I'm doing versus the things he knows that I could be doing, he gets frustrated too. I think it's part of the reason he decided he's done with the military.
Let's get right to it. The ride-sharing giant Uber is set to go public this week, and with many expecting the company to be valued at upwards of $90 billion, this could be one of the biggest initial public offerings in recent memory. And that means a lot of people are looking to make a serious amount of money once Uber stock becomes available on the New York Stock Exchange. But while investors in Silicon Valley and beyond are getting ready to celebrate Uber's IPO, many of the drivers for the ride-hailing company are upset over pay and treatment, and they have been for some time. So in some cities across the country today, drivers for Uber, as well as for their smaller competitor Lyft, are striking, hoping to bring awareness to their working conditions on the eve of Uber's historic IPO. And we asked you, our listeners, if you've had experience driving for Uber or Lyft.
My name is Pauline Cooper. I'm in Charleston, South Carolina. I drive for Uber and Lyft. I've got something like 2,000 rides in. I started out doing 40 to 60 hours a week with Uber and Lyft. Now I'm down to maybe 25.
Pauline doesn't drive in a city that's planning a big strike today, but she does echo the frustrations that many drivers experience while trying to make money with ride-hailing apps.
Uber and Lyft, unfortunately, depend on desperate people with no other recourse. Both of these companies' goals is to make everything automated with no humans involved and to keep costs down. And it's very apparent when you're the driver trying to use the cheapest software on earth to direct you somewhere and it doesn't work. Sometimes you've done a trip and it doesn't show up on your trip sheet and you didn't get paid for it. So you call to say that and you end up an hour and a half on the phone with someone who doesn't understand you and doing what they hope you will do, you say, you know what, never mind, and you don't get paid.
There's already a yawning gap between executives at the top and the drivers who make ride-hailing businesses possible, and it's about to get a lot bigger. Andrew Hawkins is following Uber closely, and he's a senior reporter covering transportation at The Verge. Andrew, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely.
So Uber's planning on going public with a big IPO this week. What are the basics here? How long has this been in coming?
This is probably about a decade in the making, honestly. Uber's been around for, you know, over that period of time, and they have stayed private for much longer than companies traditionally would of that size. And they're part of this sort of unicorn class of companies that have been valued at, you know, privately at over $1 billion. And it's going to be pretty big. It's I guess that's probably underselling it. But this is going to be about the biggest IPO since Facebook, since Alibaba. Wow. I mean, it's going to be pretty huge.
Now, we know that Uber's smaller competitor Lyft went public in March, but that did not go as planned, right? I mean, what were some of the hiccups that they experienced?
Well, they came in at a certain valuation. They started selling stock. And then pretty quickly, soon after, the stock started going down. And it's pretty clear that stock was overvalued. Lyft now is just posted its first earnings report just yesterday, and they reported that they've lost $1.1 billion in that first quarter, which is much more than they had been losing previous to that. And it's about on par with what Uber loses on per quarter. And Lyft is much smaller than Uber. So that's a pretty shocking number to see.
Is Uber, I would imagine, given what you just said about Lyft's earnings coming out yesterday, Uber executives are probably trying to figure out a lesson from this. Is there anything they can learn from what happened with Lyft?
Yeah, I think they're probably going to take a more conservative approach to their IPO. It was reported that Uber was going to try to come in at a $120 billion valuation. Now they're coming in at a $91 billion valuation. I mean, this is, you know,
billions and billions
of dollars still, but a significant difference. So it seems that they're going to try to take a little bit more of a measured approach to their IPO, knowing what happened to Lyft is likely to happen to them as well. We saw it also that when Lyft, after they went public, their stock was starting to get shorted. People were betting against their stock. And so a scenario is likely to happen with Uber as well.
Now, we talked a little bit about the yawning gap between the executives and the drivers, and we're going to get into the drivers in a minute. But who really is going to benefit from this IPO? Do we have specifics in terms of who's investing in this? Like, who do you think?
Yeah, it's the early investors. So that includes companies like Google. Jeff Bezos was a big early investor in Uber. He stands to make a lot of money. And obviously, you've got Travis Kalanick, who was the founder and CEO of Uber, was ousted in 2017 during sort of the series of scandals that hit the company. But he still has a significant stake in Uber and is likely to make something like $9 billion or something ridiculous like that. In addition to that, you've seen some of the latest investors include companies like SoftBank, which is a huge Japanese technology company, and they invest in a lot of transportation companies lately. And then you've got companies like Benchmark, which is a venture capital firm. They were a big early supporter of Uber, big early investor, and they're probably going to make something like $7 billion off of a $100 million investment that they originally made.
So a lot of people are standing to make a lot of money, billions with a B here. What about the drivers?
Yeah, the drivers, not so much. Mm. Not so much. You know, it's been a long-term problem for Uber with its drivers. They are not employees. They're freelancers. They're independent contractors. And as such, they are not entitled to receive shares in the company as other employees would, as the software engineers and the marketing folks and all those people that work for Uber at the headquarters in San Francisco. So as independent contractors, they are sort of left in this sort of limbo of space. Uber's trying to address that. They've created this sort of cash pool that they plan on handing out to some drivers to buy into the IPO at the IPO price. That's sort of determined by how many trips you've done, by what sort of driver you are. Are you a loyal driver? Do you drive pretty much exclusively for Uber? Have you done a lot of trips? Do you have a high rating? If so, Uber might give you $100. $500, maybe even up to $10,000 to buy into this IPO. It's not going to affect the broad swath of drivers, I don't think. I mean, we're talking millions of people here, but there are probably a small chunk that will stand to benefit from that program.
Given that what we just talked about, and one of our caller at the top of the segment, Pauline, is not going on strike today, but she did mention something that I think is interesting. She said that she's concerned that Uber and Lyft, I guess to a smaller extent, are trying to automate the process. Is that on the horizon? Is that something that drivers should be concerned about?
Yeah, I think it is on the horizon, and it is something that Uber is spending a lot of money on. It's a pretty costly program that they have in terms of developing autonomous vehicles with the intention of, you know, eventually removing the driver from the equation. And this is something that they've talked about for years. I mean, when Travis Kalanick was the CEO, he talked about it as an existential problem that Uber was facing, that they were a deeply unprofitable company, and that the only way that they were ever going to make money off of their business was to take the driver out and to have self-driving cars perform all the trips. Now, as we've seen with this technology over the last year or so, it's going to be a lot slower going than I think people initially thought. There was this accident, or I guess you should call it a fatal crash in Tempe, Arizona in 2018, where a self-driving Uber car ran over a 49-year-old woman and killed her. And that was a huge setback for Uber, a huge setback for the industry. So it doesn't seem likely that the driver will be taken out of the cars in the near future. But it is something that, you know, is probably maybe a decade away or maybe a little bit longer than that.
So given the fact that there is this concern about automation, that drivers are sort of, you know, in between whether they're employees or not employees, and in this case they're not, they're going on strike today. What is it that they want? What is it that they want?
So they want better wages. They want living wages. They want better working conditions. They want less, you know, think about it this way. Their boss is an algorithm. And as such, they lack a human connection to anyone else at Uber. It's sort of a disconnect there between the driver and the company. And they feel that they are sort of left to sort of struggle on their own, and they don't really have anyone looking out for them. And that means that occasionally a driver will get deactivated from the platform. They're not allowed to drive on Uber anymore because of some issue. Maybe they have a low rating or they cancel too many rides. It's not clear to them. And they lack recourse to address these issues. So that's a big deal that they have. Uber's trying to address that, but it hasn't been very systemic. And they're leaving a lot of people to fall through the gaps. And I think that that the strike is meant to address that amongst earnings and all sorts of other things as well.
And of course, there was also a strike when Lyft went public. How did that work out?
Well, I think that sort of came and went, and it was much smaller. Lyft is much smaller than Uber. So as such, there was only really a smattering of protests and striking drivers in California, I think it was. So I don't think it really had much of an impact. You need to wonder whether or not this one will have an impact too. So before I came into the studio today, I checked the Uber app and I saw that I could still get a car in 3 minutes. So it's not as if the strike is impacting Uber's business. Drivers are so diffuse, they're spread out, they're not as organized as they can be. And that's due to the fact that they don't have this classification as employees. They can't form a union to collectively bargain with Uber. And as such, they're sort of more joining these advocacy groups, Independent Drivers Guild and the Taxi Workers Alliance. It's hit or miss for them, I think, in terms of how they can organize and band together collectively to actually force Uber to make changes.
Why can't Uber turn a profit?
So
a great question. We spend lots of money on these ride sharing apps. Drivers are not making the money that they say they should make. What's going on?
So Uber loses money on every trip it performs, and that's because it's a heavily subsidized business. They spend money on the driver's side. It's a two-sided market. They spend money on the driver's side, so they're incentivizing drivers to stay on the platform because, you know, very easily they could go on to Lyft, they can go on to Juno, they can go on to Via. They're not required to be just driving for one platform, so they have to spend a lot to incentivize drivers to stay on their platform. That's cash bonuses and all these sort of gamification elements that are in Uber's app. And then on the driver's side, or on the rider's side, they have to spend on that side too. So riders are not spending the actual amount. When they pay for their Uber trip, that's not the actual amount that they're paying. The Uber is losing money on that. They're having to come in and subsidize that as well. So, it's not clear that they can make money in the near term. They have said as much to the SEC in their filing that they don't anticipate being profitable anytime soon. They're a growth company. They talk about, you know, the need to spend lots of money in order to achieve this market share that they have and to compete with their competitors. There's a low barrier of entry to come into the ride sharing industry. And as such, it's a very fiercely competitive business. They need to buy out their competitors, essentially. Maybe they'll buy out Lyft at some point. Maybe that will reduce some of their losses, but it's not going to be happening in the near term at all.
And we'll see what investors have to say about that. Andrew Hawkins is a senior reporter covering transportation at The Verge. Andrew, thank you.
Absolutely.
And we reached out to Uber and Lyft for comment. Uber has yet to respond, but Lyft told us, quote, "We know that access to flexible extra income makes a big difference for millions of people, and we're constantly working to improve how we can best serve our driver community." The New York Times has a new investigation into President Donald Trump's tax returns from 1985 to 1994 and found that his business lost more than $1 billion in that decade. The Times reported that it seems the president lost more money than any other individual in the United States over those 10 years. Those returns are not the ones that congressional Democrats are demanding he reveal, but they do suggest why Trump might not want eyes on his tax information. In the latest back and forth over President Trump's tax returns, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin is refusing to comply with a request from House Democrats to hand over Trump's tax documents. The reason? Well, he says the request, quote, lacks a legitimate legislative purpose. For a legal perspective on tax transparency for presidents, we now go to George Yin, professor of law and taxation at the University of Virginia. George, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Can you remind us again, why are House Democrats requesting President Trump's tax returns? And they've been doing this now since the beginning, right?
Right. The main argument that the Chairman Neal, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, has made is that he wants the returns to double check the IRS's auditing of President Trump's returns. Trump, as you know, has repeatedly said that he is under audit. And it, as it turns out, there have been problems in the past of the IRS's auditing of presidents. There was one very specific incident involving former President Nixon where the IRS, on its first audit, gave President Nixon a complete bill of tax health and even complimented him on how well he had prepared his returns. And then on second audit by two different organizations, the IRS again and the Joint Committee on Taxation staff, they determined that he actually owed almost $500,000 in additional tax and interest. So there has been a history of difficulty, which is understandable because there's a natural conflict of interest when an agency like the IRS has to audit someone who is, in effect, its boss. And so the Congress wants to take a look at that to make sure that the auditing is going appropriately.
Let's talk a little bit about Treasury Secretary Mnuchin's reasoning here behind his refusal to provide Trump's tax returns. He has used and invoked this phrase, legitimate legislative purpose. George, what does that mean?
Well, that essentially means a purpose that is within the constitutional responsibilities of Congress. And that's a phrase that has been used by a few court cases involving the enforcement of a subpoena. So when Congress issues a subpoena and the party that is subpoenaed refuses and the matter ends up in court, what the courts have done is they've looked at that to determine whether the investigation by Congress is within one of the constitutional responsibilities of Congress. The constitutional responsibilities are the two main ones, of course, of Congress are its lawmaking function and its oversight function. And in this case, Chairman Neal has in his letter, invoked both of those explanations as reasons why he wants to get the returns.
George, does Congress have the right to presidential tax returns?
Absolutely, because of a law, again, that was enacted almost 100 years ago, remains in the law today, which specifically gives Congress that right as long as it makes a written request of it and specifically directs Secretary Mnuchin to provide the information that was requested. The law itself, the language of the law is very straightforward, and the background of the law would support a very plain reading of the law, not requiring Chairman Neal to provide any kind of justification or purpose, but simply to make a request.
George, this latest move by Treasury Secretary Mnuchin here, this seems to fit into a pattern of avoiding congressional oversight. What can you tell us about that? What are the legalities here?
Well, the legalities are a little bit different. So in some of the other issues that have arisen, such as the problems involving Attorney General William Barr, Congress is pursuing those issues through the subpoena process. Subpoenas are obviously part one of Congress's tools in exercising its general investigative power, well-known tool to use with some case law that defines what the parameters are.
The president has said repeatedly that he cannot release his tax documents because he's being audited. What do we know about that? And is that still the standing line?
As far as I know, it's a standing line, but, you know, he tends to change frequently. So I don't know what his latest line is. There is, in fact, nothing in the law that would prohibit him from disclosing his information, even if he were under audit. And as I indicated earlier, the ironic thing is that if, in fact, he is under audit, that actually gives Congress more of a reason to look at the returns and look at the auditing process because of the prior history of that activity.
We understand that there are different types of tax documents we're talking about when we talk about what the New York Times uncovered and what Congress is asking for. But does what the New York Times uncovered give us any indication about why the president and the Treasury Secretary would want to hide these documents from Congress?
I think the Times' story today is very interesting. Whether it, you know, provides a reason, I guess it still remains to be seen. Obviously, I only know the information that's in the story. Pretty much of the information of the story has been assumed by knowledgeable tax people over this period of time, simply because of the nature of the kind of business that he's been in. I think the numbers are rather startlingly high. That is, the amount of losses that he was reporting was very considerable, I think over $1 billion over the decade. And so that respect, I think the information was pretty revealing. But in terms of the actual, what the tax returns would say, I think it's pretty much consistent with what most knowledgeable tax people would have expected.
What options does Congress have if the president and or the Treasury Secretary do not hand over the president's tax returns?
Well, again, I think that what Congress should do is should sue Secretary Mnuchin for his failure to comply with the law, which directs him to provide the information that has been requested. That seems to me the most straightforward way and the way that is most likely to end up with a favorable decision on Congress's side.
George Yin is a law professor at the University of Virginia School of Law. George, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
As we approach Memorial Day, the takeaway is looking at the challenges that military families face. And when we asked you what those were, there was one thing that came up again and again.
I remember when I was a military spouse, the hardest thing for me was finding a job.
The spouse's resumes don't realistically reflect their vast experiences.
I have a hard time getting hired because I am a spouse, and therefore when he moves, I move.
The one thing that the employers always asked me was, what if your husband has to transfer tomorrow?
I have a job now, and my husband is stationed 4 hours away, and I see him 3 days a week, and it shouldn't have to be that way.
The dependents are the unsung heroes that deserve so much more.
That's so hard. It really is.
That last voice you heard was
Carla Candelaria Oquendo. I live in Charleston, South Carolina. My husband's name is Romualdo Avila Taveras. He is an E6 nuclear electrician's mate, and I am an environmental health manager at the Medical University of South Carolina.
And you also heard from the husband of
Katie Kirsch. I live in the Silicon Valley, and my husband is in the Air Force. He's an E8. And he's a pararescueman for the Air National Guard. And I'm an executive assistant at an edtech startup company.
Carla and Katie both have full-time jobs, and that's no small feat, as one quarter of military spouses are unemployed and another 30% work part-time. And while both of them say their work is important, their current jobs are far different than what they had imagined for themselves.
What I thought I would be doing was working in the aerospace industry or possibly defense, as my goal ultimately is to promote space habitability and work on aerospace space design.
I have a master's degree in history, and I saw myself going into teaching. It just wasn't feasible with my husband's schedule.
I talked to both Katie and Carla about the challenges they've faced in their own careers while their husbands have been in the military. For Carla, it started with working low-wage jobs while she finished her master's degree in human factors and engineering.
While I was doing my master's, I worked at the Publix deli, cutting meats and making subs. And that was after having my bachelor's degree. I worked as a paraprofessional in Duval County Public Schools in Florida, which basically I was reteaching children who did not speak English the lesson in their language and helping them transition into
fully understanding the lessons in English.
And I'm curious, for both of you, you're not doing the thing that you thought you would be doing. So, Katie, I want to start with you here. How do you think the military approaches spouses' careers?
You know, I do think they recognize that it's very difficult for spouses to keep a full-time job with their many moves. For example, teachers, you know, they need credentials in different states and they don't always reciprocate. So there are networks available that women can and men can try to help them, but it doesn't always translate. Businesses are looking for people with, you know, long histories of employment. They don't look upon, you know, skipping around jobs as a good thing, which is what military spouses have to do.
Carla, what about you? How do you feel the military approaches spouses' careers specifically?
Well, I think the intentions are there. I've definitely seen the evolution of the speech we get when we go to our spouse conferences and job fairs, but the resources and the actions are not meeting the words and the intentions. You know, we get these speeches about, well, just say you're a military wife, employers know, employers are here. We talk to them, they want to support you, they want to hire you. But when we go to the job fairs, and I've gone to some that are spouse-oriented, some that are veteran-oriented, but spouses are welcome, you really see the dichotomy. You really see that spouses are being offered jobs as a barista at Starbucks or as a teller at a bank, as a sales executive maybe, but not the type of opportunities that can launch you into a long-term career.
And of course, there are other roles that both of you play. Katie, you are also a mom. You have children. Did that affect your career path while your husband was in the military or is in the military?
Absolutely. You know, most military spouses don't have their family near them. They're not able to help them. So especially living in the Bay Area where the cost of living is so high, the cost of childcare is very high. Where my husband is stationed is not like a full-fledged military base, so we don't have childcare on site. There was no way that I could afford childcare, so I had to stay home with the kids. I had to finish my master's degree. Even when I finished, it was still difficult to find a job that could balance the cost of childcare. And like I said, when I wanted to go into teaching, you know, to start out as an adjunct professor, to start fresh out the door, you know, you're going to get the classes that the tenured professors don't want. You're going to get the 8 a.m.s and the 6 p.m.s. And a military spouse with a deploying husband or wife needs basically a 9-to-5 job, because you're going to have months on end with no one to help you at night, no one to help you those early mornings. So I started my career much later in life than a lot of my friends who aren't military spouses.
I'm wondering if either one of you, when you became a military spouse, I mean, I'm sure you expected challenges, but did you expect challenges when it came to your career?
Absolutely not. You know, we talk so much, especially, you know, around election time, about how much we care about the military and we support military families and, you know, the fairy tale that we tell everybody out there when we want them to enlist. So I expected challenges like the distance and, you know, maybe my husband having long hours or different hours. I expected moving to places. I knew that would be a thing, but I also expected a lot more help and maybe more flexibility. So I've been fortunate that my husband has been able to go to places where he's either close to me or close to industry, which is where he is now. And he has a group of coworkers, all of whom have the same qualifications, the same experience, but different aspirations. And the ones that want to stay get orders to leave, and the ones that want to leave get orders to stay. I don't think it's well thought out. I think the military is still living in the days of the right stuff, right? When we had our first aviators and our first astronauts, and the wives were, you know, this pretty picture, perfectly manicured, and they understand and see that we want something more, but they still sort of expect us to fit that mold. it's been a lot of challenges that I didn't expect in places where, honestly, it doesn't make sense to me. These should not be challenges. These should be easy fixes.
And, of course, there are other elements to any relationship. We're talking about the impact that this has on military spouses. Katie, we learned about your story because your husband, Sean, called us when we asked for stories about the challenges that military families face, and I want to play his call.
My wife has finally found her dream job at a startup company at the very tail end of my 25-year military career. We can't afford to stay in the Bay Area, though. She's followed me and taken care of our two kids, ages 7 and 9, on top of her full-time job for months sometimes. Her only reward is having her spouse back home.
Katie, how did that call from Sean make you feel?
Sorry, I'm trying not to get emotional. I'm emotional about it because the job I have now is definitely, I don't know if I'd say it's my dream job because I didn't dream of having this job, but now that I have the job I have, I love it. I love the people I work with. I love our mission. And it makes me sad to think that the reason why I can't continue is because of the cost of living of the area. Where we live now, our housing is subsidized and we can make it work right now. But I don't know what the future holds when my husband is retired. We won't be able to afford where we live. So I would be facing a really long commute or I don't know what. But I do know that I love the job I have. And you know, and I have followed my husband from day one for 12 years. In his journey. And so part of me wants to say, well, I want to continue my journey. You know, it's my turn for you to follow me. But I have to think of, you know, what's good for our family. And, you know, we didn't put our time into the military for so long to come out of it and then struggle with affordable living.
That is the truth, I have to say. Carla, what about you? Has this affected your relationship with your husband?
Well, first, Katie, I completely feel for you. I got emotional there, too. What your husband says is something that I've heard a lot of service members say, both male and female, kids or no kids. It's really the truth. Honestly, it takes a toll. My husband and I fell in love with each other because we're both nerds and we love to talk about science and the future and we love to question things. And he appreciates me for, you know, the person I am. So when he sees me underused, frustrated with where I am in my career, when I tell him about the things I'm doing versus the things he knows that I could be doing, he gets frustrated too. And it definitely affects him. I think it's part of the reason he decided he's done with the military. Also, while I have a job that has amazing impact and value for my career, I am very much underpaid compared to my peers. People with my bachelor's degree start a job about 20 grand more than where I am right now with a master's degree. And so with my student loans, I've had to take a second job. So I drive Lyft almost every afternoon after work and sometimes on the weekends. So my work week is now about, you know, 50 to 60 to 70 hours instead of 40. So it just complicates things because it's something that on one hand gives you beautiful things and supports you and takes you to your limit and pushes you to be better every single day. But at the same time, it limits what great things we can do. It's not that we cannot do great things while being military spouses. It's that we don't have the choices to do the great things we want to do or that we would excel at.
We talked about how this is impacting both of your relationships with your spouses, with your husbands. Katie, how has this impacted your children?
My children were born into this, and they're always living in transition. Like, you know, we live in a rented home, and they know that this isn't our forever home. They are constantly seeing friends come and go. They're constantly seeing my husband come and go, and they don't quite understand the danger involved, which is good. But the older they get it. Like one of my husband's, you know, coworkers passed away from a parachuting accident. And so every time my husband goes to jump, they think about it and they ask about his friend. And they have a lot more worries than I think the average child growing up.
Kitty, what do you think the military could do better to support spouses in their careers, to support wherever they are in their lives, whether they're parents or not parents? But what are you needing from the military that you aren't getting right now?
Personally, I think one thing would be to really consider where these military, even, you know, federal government employees, where their families are living. And if they're not living at a military base with childcare and grocery stores and, you know, mental health facilities, you know, they need to offer more to these families. And the military does try to provide a cost of living stipend, but it in no way comes close to realizing that cost.
Carla, what about you? What would you like for the military to do better to help you and other people who are in this situation right now?
Honestly, money, because we are limited in what we can do. We are limited in what we can achieve. And I wish I could pay for those certifications. I wish I could not work a second job on top of everything. And finally, make the time somebody spends in a place a little longer, because 2 years is not enough to get a degree sometimes. 2 years is not enough to buy a house. 2 years is not enough to do a lot of things. So while our peers are investing their paycheck in the house that they bought, we are losing our housing allowance on properties that we cannot really grow or invest or depend on.
Is there anything that you would like to ask each other, or any advice you want to offer each other or other military spouses who may be going through this?
I think as military spouses, you need to make the best of the situation that you're in and make friends and build communities around you that will support you to be able to do the things you want to do. I got my amazing job through my neighbor, who is also a military wife. And I think if we all, you know, just still stick together and help each other, you know, we can live our best lives with what we have.
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to know, as a spouse, you are not alone, is the biggest thing we need to hear. Because sometimes you're the only one that wants a career in a group full of children. And sometimes you're the only one that wants children in a group of women who want careers, or men. And look for things outside of what you're told. Look for things out there. Look and ask and bother and ask and bother, but don't stop.
Carla Candelaria Oquendo and Katie Kirsch, thank you for being with me. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Tensina, for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Carla is currently an environmental health manager at the Medical University of South Carolina, and Katie is an executive assistant at an educational technology company in Silicon Valley. And we're still collecting the stories of the challenges that military families face ahead of Memorial Day, and we want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8MYTAKE and tell us what's been difficult for your family. And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.